Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Sally O'Cordy, and welcome to Public Advocate. I am running for Public Advocate of New York City to ban vaccines in 2013. I'm giving it my all. Please check my blog where you will see many alternative ways of taking action. Very important. Okay, I have a wonderful guest coming up. I have reached out to the 10th Amendment Center because I'd like to nullify the CDC schedule and pandemic laws, and they're going to look into it and see if that's possible to do at the state level. Currently, I'm working to on a resolution against the NDAA provisions 1021 and 22, and I started with a resolution that I got from the 10th Amendment Center, and then I heard from a gentleman by the name of Dennis Marburger. I have just been running, so I'm a little bit out of breath. I'm sorry about that, but I would like to give a proper introduction to Dennis Marburger from Michigan, and you will see a wonderful photo of him flashing on the screen with a Michigan baseball cap. Okay, cheerio. Let's go out now.
Hi, Sally. How are you?
Well, I'm just fine, thank you. I love that picture with you in the Michigan baseball cap. I hope you don't mind if I use that.
Oh, no, I love that cap, too. And I worked to the football games and all around and worked to the Republican National Convention down in Tampa, where I did my best to spread the good word about the 10th Amendment and the importance of local and state resistance to federal tyranny, and the work done by the 10th Amendment Center and other liberty groups. So that is that's certainly
now
fine.
Now, you brought up the Republican Party, but I know the 10th Amendment Center does not play party politics.
No, they do not. Some members, like in many groups, there will be members who will be involved in different ways and in trying to get the message out. And the 10th Amendment Center is strictly outside of the political party spectrum as an organization, but individuals sometimes mm-hmm. will get involved. And as you know, there are a number of us who over the last several years have become involved with the political process, working with different parties, and with the goal of moving them towards a liberty orientation.
I tell people that this is the most bipartisan issue in the world, freedom. Because when you're fighting for freedom, everything else is gone. We're down to it. We're at freedom.
Well, you're absolutely right about that, Sally. And I believe that a lady named Chris Ann Hall out of Florida, who does great work explaining about the Constitution and the genealogy of the Constitution and all the founding documents and our principles, summed it up very well when she was up here in Michigan a few weeks ago and came to one of our group meetings. And so the crisis we really face is a moral crisis. And that explains why there seem to be so many things coming at us from so many different directions. And so the moral crisis is, I believe, the root of our problem. But it also manifests itself in many political ways, of course. And one of those is the inversion of the American Federal Union from one in which there are strong constitutional safeguards and prohibitions against the government in Washington, D.C. attacking the liberty of the people, into one in which the government in Washington, D.C. thinks that we work for them and that the states and localities are to be their subsidiaries. That is, of course, diametrically opposed to the ratified contract between the states which established that federal union and which included in itself protections for our liberty, including in the definition of treason in Article 3, Section 3, which says making war against the states and giving aid and comfort to their enemies was treason in the view of the Constitution, but also included the 9th and 10th Amendments, and of course the 10th Amendment said that any power not granted by that document, that is the Constitution, to the federal government or prohibited by it to the states, was reserved for the people and the states. And of course the 9th Amendment said that the people's rights were not to be were not delineated by this document, but we kept all the rights that we had previously, and the states, of course, kept their duty to protect those rights. And that's the basis on which Thomas Jefferson came up with the idea of nullification, and James Madison with his phrase or his word for it, interposition.
I didn't realize that word came from James Madison to describe nullification. Very interesting. Interposition. I've heard it so many times, I just didn't know the root of it or the exact meaning for that matter. You can conjure what it means, but it's better to hear it.
Would you like me to explain it?
Yes, please. I'd appreciate that.
Sure. I'd be delighted. Sally, these words were particularly used initially back in 1798. And that was, we had 8 years of constitutional government before that, or the Constitutional Union, before that we had the Articles of Confederation. But the gentlemen got together in Philadelphia for a meeting that was advertised as a review of the Articles of Confederation. And the idea was, promoted by James Madison and some others, that perhaps they needed to give them some revisions and to strengthen the general government, which is their word for what we now call the federal government. Patrick Henry wouldn't go. He said, "I smell a rat." They wanted George Washington to go. He only went after a very interesting series of events regarding Shays' Rebellion. But by the time the Constitution was done and ratified, they had done that on the condition that there would be a Bill of Rights, and also the states retained the right of rescission to take their powers back. In other words, we might say secede, as they had done from the British Empire initially, and then they later did from the Confederation. And we have this Bill of Rights, which included in it the provision of the 10th Amendment, and also the preamble of the Bill of Rights, which said it only served to restrict the federal government. Well, 8 years after this had happened, and we had George Washington as our first constitutional president, John Adams was elected president, and he became tired of criticism of himself, people making fun of him, criticizing his administration. And so Adams and his Federalist Party, which is probably a misnomer, but that's what they called themselves, they put through the Alien and Sedition Acts. Now, Thomas Jefferson was Adams' vice president, and Jefferson and Adams were political rivals. Back in that day, they didn't have tickets. You had a candidate for president from each of these two parties, and the presidential candidate who came in second was the vice president. So Jefferson was Adams' vice president. When Adams said through the Alien and Sedition Acts that anyone who criticized the government and was not a sitting member of the Senate or the House in session on the floor of their chamber, whenever anybody did that, the federal government was now going to have that person arrested.
Well, that included his vice president.
Well, that's an interesting point. Now, the vice president at the time, Jefferson, complained about that. And, of course, he'd be the president of the Senate, so I guess he could have been there. But Jefferson complained, and he said, well, this is an outrage. We have a natural right to speak freely, and that natural right is protected in the First Amendment. The federal government may not attack that natural right. Adams basically said, okay, well, we'll make one exception. They can criticize the vice president. And Jefferson goes up. Yes. Right. Jefferson said, that's hilarious. And so he goes off to Kentucky, and he writes the Kentucky Resolves or Resolution, and working together with the governor and the legislature in Kentucky, they said that anyone who came in from the federal government and attempted to attack the natural right of free speech and violate the First Amendment, any federal agent or officer or soldier who did that would be physically opposed by the Kentucky militia, the Kentucky State Militia, and that the people of Kentucky still had this right, and the feds had no right to take it away from them. Now, he also called this, nullification. They were going to nullify this. And he said that nullification, Sally, is the rightful remedy. You see, because Kentucky had the moderate middle ground, so it's the rightful remedy to federal usurpations, federal violations of the contract between the states. And you might think of the general government, or what we call the federal government, as the agent of the people of the states. The states are the agents of their people. The states, acting in their role as agents, created another sub-agent, if you will, the federal or general government, and they had a contract which said this is what these people are allowed to do. They were delegated certain powers that is the general government. When they went outside those powers, Jefferson said it's the rightful remedy of the people of the states, acting through their agents of the states, to enforce the Constitution. You see, he also said it was the moderate middle ground, and he called it the moderate middle ground because unlike the war for independence or the secession from the British Empire, and they said, well, it's the right to secede, but that doesn't mean they necessarily want to, and certainly you're not going to do it over every issue. That's a very infrequent thing, they said, and they even said in the Declaration of Independence. But as a moderate middle ground, when they don't want to submit to tyranny, and they want to stay in the general grouping, they want to stay in the Union, then the states were to nullify these unconstitutional acts. Now, Madison went to Virginia, and he and Jefferson were close friends and of similar philosophy. And Madison wrote the Virginia Resolves of 1798, but he used the word interposition, and he said the states are duty-bound to interpose, to stand between the people of the states and the feds, when the feds, again, are violating the constitutional limits that were placed on them and attacking the people's liberty. So he said interposition, and some people use that as an even maybe slightly stronger term than nullification. Nullification can include noncompliance, for instance, by states. We frequently see that. That's a very important tool in the arsenal to protect freedom. Interposition suggests not only noncompliance, but active resistance. And back then, Sally, Virginia and Kentucky, as with the other states, had strong state militias. The general government had a relatively weak military establishment, and so the people's rights were more likely to be defended. So that's where those words came from. Interestingly, there was a congressman, Lyons of Vermont, I believe, who did criticize the Adams administration while going around Vermont. He was arrested and thrown into jail. He ran for re-election in the election of 1800. Thomas Jefferson was Adams' opponent again. The election was a very bitter one. It was famous for the mudslinging and the personal attacks and all that sort of thing. It was very close, and it came down to apparently the Electoral College being tied, so they went to Congress. And so it came down to one congressman from his jail cell, Congressman Lyons. I say from his jail cell rhetorically. I don't know that he was actually physically there. He might have been back in Congress at that point, actually sitting in the Capitol. But anyway, Lyons cast a deciding vote for Thomas Jefferson. And this fight to nullify the attack on our freedom of speech and to interpose against it went on for those 2 years, but then Jefferson and his party got in, and they eventually were able to get rid of that horrible provision. But that's interesting history, isn't it?
Oh, my Lord, that is fascinating. I didn't know any of that. I did the whole story of interposition and the fact that a state elected official who was criticizing the federal government and then wound up in jail. It was the deciding vote. This is fascinating stuff. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. And now I will say that the 10th Amendment Center, 10thAmendmentCenter.com, has just a wealth of resources on this. The educational opportunities. There are videos that you can see from their Nullify Now conferences when you go onto YouTube and see those. All sorts of articles that are written on the 10th Amendment Center. Michael Bolden, who is the executive director and the founder of the 10th Amendment Center, will do various. They do these broadcasts on Wednesday evenings, Tenther Radio. I think it's Wednesdays at 9 o'clock Eastern Time, 6 o'clock California time. They're out in Los Angeles, as it turns out. And there are some great books that have been written. The communications director of the 10th Amendment Center is another wonderful person, wonderful fellow, the marvelous Mike Meharry, who is an excellent writer and speaker, as is Mr. Bolden and the others that are involved, and the great Nick Hankoff, who helps them. And Meharry's written a book called Our Last Hope, and it talks about utilizing the doctrines of nullification and interposition in various forms to defeat tyranny now and to help us be more free. And there was a book several years ago written by one of America's greatest writers and historians, and very knowledgeable in many fields, a PhD, Dr. Thomas E. Woods, Jr. And Dr. Woods wrote a book called Nullification, The Tool for Resisting Federal Tyranny in the 21st Century. It's a tremendous book. So you can say that Tom Woods literally wrote the book when it comes to nullification. And
I'll definitely read that book. Let me tell you, I will read that book.
Oh, yes, it's extremely well written. And he goes into the story about what happened back there in 1798. And then they also go back into some of the other aspects where nullification came up. And it was interesting, both nullification and secession were items that, you know, back then in the earlier days of the American Republic were tools that people were looking at to do various things at various times. Another very famous thing that happened, a very important and noble example of using nullification, was during the 1850s, when one of the worst pieces of legislation ever devised was put forward. And those were the Fugitive Slave Acts. Now, they passed to the legislature, the president signed them, the Supreme Court gave its imprimatur. But, of course, the Supreme Court, you see, this is very important, another very important point, Sally, the Supreme Court gives opinions. And they give opinions that are utilized by, again, the general government, the other two branches. The Supreme Court is the judicial branch at the head of the general government, but we also have legislative and executive branches. Sometimes they might disagree on things, but the Supreme Court gives an opinion to them. So then you say, well, gee, today everybody says, well, when the Supreme Court rules, what they say goes. You know, one black-robed magician going from one side of an issue to another tells 300 million people how they have to live. That seems like an odd way for the founders to have established things, and they didn't, actually. And what they said, and again, Jefferson, Hamilton, and Madison, the others said, well, the final arbiter are the people of the states. Again, we have to remember that the states formed that federal union, and they had a contract among themselves. So they certainly wouldn't have the federal government, any aspect of it, determining what the federal government's powers are. That would be akin to a family, a mother and father having some children and letting the children decide what their powers were, when they can go to bed and how much they can stay up, what their allowance is going to be and that sort of thing, but in a much more serious vein by these governmental units. And so in the 1850s, when the terrible Fugitive Slave Act was passed, I think there was more than one of them, as I recall, northern states fought them. Northern states, such as our great state of Michigan and in Wisconsin and in Connecticut and a bunch of the northern states, refused to participate. They passed laws that provided either for noncompliance or for active resistance. And I know in Michigan we passed personal liberty laws, you see, that the courts will not participate in this. They will not allow bounty hunters to come up here and take people away and take them back down south and sell, put them back into bondage. And if there is any sort of a crime or a charge against somebody, that has to be adjudicated properly, and we have to have the writ of habeas corpus, and we have to have a trial giving all due process. And, of course, as you're thinking to yourself now, Sally, that, gee, this has echoes of some more current events, and you're absolutely right. But back then, in the 1850s, the Michigan legislature heroically stood up to this horrible injustice, motivated both by morality, which is the first basis on which to do things, and, of course, people always have the duty to act in a moral fashion and to stand up for the rights of others and their own rights, but also as elected officials, they had those who took the oath of office had a legal and constitutional duty to enforce that document, to uphold that oath of office, to fulfill it, which says they will uphold the Constitution. And that's the Michigan legislature and governor did. And as I say, a lot of other states did. In fact, in Wisconsin, they had this really dramatic case. And Mike Meharry tells the story beautifully. If you get a chance to look this up, the story of Joshua Glover, and I think there are some video versions of this. You can watch Mike speaking at some of these conferences, including one they did in Cincinnati, where the 10th Amendment Center had a Nullify Now conference focusing on the anniversary of the Underground Railroad, which they pointed out was a form, using the Underground Railroad and freeing the slaves, that way was a form of personal nullification. And so he tells the story of Joshua Glover, who actually with Joshua, and I don't recall exactly how they picked Glover to be his last name, but he didn't know what his last name was. He was a slave, but he eventually was able to get into out of the slave states and into the northern states. He was I think in Illinois, having gotten there from Missouri, where he had been a slave, and then he was with another slave or ex-slave who actually sold them out to bounty hunters. And so they put him back into bondage. Well, he escaped again, and he got to Milwaukee. And the people of Milwaukee said that they were going to watch out for him. Then the word got out that there were bounty hunters, and they were going to capture him. And they did. And I believe the sheriff in Milwaukee and the thousands of people rallied and gathered for Joshua Glover's sake and for his safety and freedom. And they did free him, and it was a confrontation. He eventually got to Canada by steamship and was freed from slavery there. But the northern states rose up and nullified the Fugitive Slave Act. And they were so effective at it that when Jefferson Davis gave his farewell address to the United States Senate, and when the state of South Carolina issued their Declaration of Secession, and again, secession is a very American doctrine. It's what the founders did. It's what we celebrate on July 4th, or should be if we know what we're doing. So that part of it was certainly their right to do, but not all their reasons were the best. And one of the things they specifically mentioned, both Jefferson Davis leading the Senate and the state of South Carolina issuing their Declaration of Secession, they were mad at the northern states of, and they named each of them, and I remember being from Michigan, seeing that Michigan was there, and they had to say Connecticut and Wisconsin, and quite a few of them, actually. And they said that these states nullified the Fugitive Slave Act. And I say, thank God for that. You're darn right they did. And every once in a while, it doesn't happen that often, but governmental people do the right thing. And this is a heroic and noble thing that those northern states did.
Well, I would like to bring this into the present by saying what I'm doing and then asking you what you're doing, okay? Because you're in Michigan and I'm in New York. I heard about the 10th Amendment Center after a friend of mine said, you have to start a petition in support of Chris Hedges. And I said, and his NDAA pushback. And I said, I can't, because he's only doing it on behalf of journalists. And second only to children, I believe journalists should be protected, you know. But nonetheless, he was not doing it on behalf of everybody. He was doing it on behalf of a certain group, and that just wasn't good enough. So I saw that that the 10th Amendment Center was promoting nullification of the NDAA 1021 and 1022 sections of that bill, of the National Defense Authorization Act. So I thought, well, what I'm going to do is get a citizen's petition. My friend Mary Joyce recommended a citizen's petition in support of Chris Hedges. And I thought, I can only get one going. I need it to cover everybody. So the 10th Amendment Center entered my life through Facebook or through an email. I don't know how. And I thought, this looks good. I'm definitely going to pursue this. And first, I will get petitions. So I got a citizen's petition in Boston, I know, and so such is it, I believe, too, with New York. It's just 10 signatures of registered voters. And it was to nullify. It was not for a resolution. It was a statewide nullification. Now, what I did was I said to everybody, I will hold all the signatures I get for the whole state. And if you can get a resolution going locally, I will send you these signatures for the whole state. So we can use these signatures in double duty. So, and you only needed 10, but we had many more than that, a lot more than that, and I got them from Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians, and peace activists, a Green Party, you name it. Everybody was hep to not being indefinitely detained without charge or trial. Everybody was hep to that. But it was, in fact, Stuart Rhodes who got me off the couch, because he said the magic words. He said, you know, it doesn't say anywhere here that you have to be 18. Well, I have worked against child trafficking in this country for quite some time. And when he said you don't have to be 18, I thought, oh, Lord, they're going to take our kids and they're going to traffic them. I just couldn't help but put two and two together and say, you don't need a charge, you don't need a trial, and you don't have to be 18 to be detained here or abroad indefinitely. Well, so I ran to the state legislators that I knew. None of them took it, but a local woman took it as a resolution. It is almost complete, and I would love to announce it on the air right now, but I want her to
to call a press conference and make a big deal of it. She is a big deal for saying yes. So I'm going to ask you, what have you achieved in Michigan?
Well, we have very interesting developments to share with you, Sally, so I'm really pleased that you asked, and I'm very glad to hear about all the great work you're doing there. And let me point out, that was an interesting observation that Stuart Rhodes gave you. Let's not forget, Anwar al-Awlaki's son, the 16-year-old, was murdered by drone overseas, and the son, as with al-Awlaki, they were both Americans. And when you mentioned about the lack of the 18-year-old age limit in there in terms of this indefinite
right.
detention.
Well, I want you to know I also have a resolution against drones with the same woman. Local.
Okay, well, you're doing great work there. Well, here's what's happened in Michigan, and we've been fortunate to have some really good folks working on this. And there's a bunch of groups working together, the 10th Amendment Center and, you know, the Oath Keepers and the Campaign for Liberty and people against the NDAA, the ACLU, Republican
Patriot
Liberty Caucus.
Patriot Coalition, Panda.
Yeah, they're part of it, too. Yeah, so we formed a really big all sorts of people working together on this. And, of course, you know, you get the groups of people together. Sometimes different people have different ideas about what should be done and how to do it. Thank you, and that sort of thing. And so what we did, though we were very fortunate, we were able to get two counties here in Michigan. Allegan County, which is on the west side of the state, not too far from Grand Rapids, and Oakland County, where I am, which is just north of Detroit, to pass very strong resolutions. And yes, we were working with verbiage, wording we got. These resolutions were created by Blake Filippi, who is the legal analyst that works at the 10th Amendment Center. And Blake is
really?
A wonderful fellow. Oh, yes. And he's done
like
some great speaking,
him.
By the way.
Wonderful.
Yes. Yes, and you can see Blake Filippi speaking, I think, in Philadelphia at an LFI Now conference. He it's a home run. He's tremendous. Well, it took a while in both of these counties, but as you pointed out, in your situation, people of different political persuasions, maybe no political persuasion, but as people found out what was going on, we were able to get them through. And one of the things that we had to deal with is the idea that, well, gee, why is a county government having anything to say about the NDAA or anything else that comes out of Washington, D.C.? Because, again, Sally, unfortunately, the idea of what federalism is sometimes completely turned upside down these days, and people don't understand what's really going on with that. And they don't understand that in federalism, just, you know, the people are sovereign. They can delegate some of their sovereignty to the local governmental unit, which then can delegate some more going up the chain, so to speak, you know, as you get farther away from home. And again, the way our constitutional union is set up, we're supposed to tell the feds, you work for us, and these are the limits we put on you. Well, seeing the horrible nature of the vagary in the wording of the NDAA provisions and the way they let themselves all this wiggle room to do terrible things to the people of Allegan County and Oakland County and all over America, eventually we were able to get these county commissions with the work of some really great commissioners, Bill Sage in Allegan County and Jim Runstead here in Oakland County, and also Commissioner Mathis here in Oakland County. But we were able to get these things passed. And our Oakland County went through unanimously. We got some good publicity for the fight from that. And we have a state legislator named Tom McMillan, a state representative from our county. He's up in Rochester Hills. Tom has legislation. Again, from the 10th Amendment Center, and it's non-compliance legislation. So the first step is to get really awakening the other legislators and the people around the state. But we got it passed by the House last year unanimously.
Wonderful.
Then we were trying, yes, ma'am. Well, Sally, then we were trying to get it through the state Senate. Now, you know how these legislatures have their rules. We were there. It finally got down to the last day of the legislative session, and another fellow and I went up there. Somebody who's done a lot of lobbying of the state government and was up there saying, you guys might want to come up here and talk to the Senate Majority Leader and that sort of thing. We really tried hard to get it through. But he said, oh, well, I didn't realize how important it was, this, that, and the other. And he'd taken it off the calendar. And, you know, they were there until 5 in the morning passing all sorts of ridiculous stuff, you know, but this thing was really important. But we start again. It's gotten through the House. It's gone through the Senate. The wording, I guess, is not quite exactly the same. So they have another version in the Senate, but we're very close to getting this through. And then they're sending it over to Governor Snyder. and hopefully he would sign it. So that's what that's where we are so far, and we have another step that we'd like to do, Sally, which is the folks again, Oath Keepers and the Intolerable Acts and the Patriot Coalition have a group, IntolerableActs.org, and they have something called Restoring Constitutional Governance Act, and so that's my goal. Our goal is to have that as the next step.
I know it well because after we went through the resolution for the NDAA and the legal division of the council, of the local council, which covers, by the way, 8 million of the 18 million in New York State. So this would almost half. Yes, well, I basically said after going back and forth for a year, and they hadn't yet issued, to my knowledge, and I've been working with the Patriot Coalition, Jeff Lewis and Richard Fry, and I've been introduced to them by Dan Johnson of Panda Unite.
You bet.
And so basically I said to them in the final analysis, we will either go, we had started with the 10th Amendment Center resolution, so you know, and we went from there, and and I got a lot of advice from the Patriot Coalition. Finally, they said, I said to the councilwoman, in the final analysis, you are submitting this. I would like very much, instead of this resolution, as it stands now, and we've worked back and forth for a very long time with many people involved, including Stuart Rhodes of the Oath Keepers. But his idea was great, treat it like a kidnapping. You know, I was like, bingo, say no more. That's where I'm at, you know. However, the Restoring Constitutional Governance, however, covers a multitude. So I was really hoping, and I won't know until it happens, which one she signed. But I hope it's Restoring Constitutional Governance.
Well, yeah, that's great stuff. And I know I discussed it with Michael Bolden at the 10th Amendment Center, and he liked it too. So these things, sometimes, you know, we make progress in steps, and that's important. And here's the other great thing.
Well, I think I may have a state senator here in New York that I may be able to work with. So this is very exciting to do it at the state level as well, you know.
Oh, you bet. Yeah, because, yeah, we definitely want to do it at the state level where as much as we can, and we want to keep working at the county level. And, you know, there are these different techniques and tools that we can use to fight against the Leviathan state and a runaway general government, as they did way back when. But we can utilize the nullification, the interposition, sheriff's interposition. All these things, I think, are very helpful. Now, you asked,
we have a dilemma here in New York. Our sheriff is appointed by the mayor.
Oh.
So that's a huge dilemma. This is not a standalone sheriff.
Yes, that is a huge dilemma. Well, that's a problem because, yeah, we need Richard Mack to get over there and straighten
out. Not about the state, only in the city, only in the five boroughs of the city.
Okay, all right.
But still, that's 8 million people again. That's almost half the state, and we don't have a sheriff.
Yeah, and that's an interesting conundrum. Well, the thing I was going to say was utilizing these different techniques. You know, the NDAA situation is critical. So would be targeted killings, you know, extrajudicial killings and that sort of thing, and so many things that the people in Washington, D.C. are doing that they should not be doing. And yet, there's a whole lot of other issues. And so you asked earlier when we were chatting before the interview, you said, well, what other items is the 10th Amendment Center working on in terms of nullifying?
I'm eager to know because I'm hoping that we can work together to nullify the Center for Disease Control's vaccine schedule and the pandemic laws, because not only do we need to nullify them, but we need to warn every governmental employee who might be assigned to force inoculate people under a false pandemic or a created pandemic. And this is, we need to warn them, do not participate in this. But canceling the CDC schedule is the first step. Children are dying every single day. This country doesn't understand. Children are dying, and no one's getting arrested, and it's because of these vaccines.
Well, some of the
68th in the world on day of birth survival because of these vaccines.
Well, some of the issues that I know have groups around the state, around the federal union. I want to say around our federal union. We got some great state chapters that are doing all sorts of interesting work. We talked about the NDAA situation. Obamacare is another one. There's a lot of work being done to resist the attempts by the feds to say, oh, you must buy this product, and if you don't, we'll fine you, and we'll do more in the healthcare and medical areas. None of those are powers that were delegated by the people of the states to the feds. And so it's right and proper, and it's the duty of the states to fight back against that and to not have their people oppressed that way. And so...
Well, in York, we just had a child forced inoculated in school and without her mother's even knowledge of it, and they won the case, but then the health commission, they appealed, and because of the pandemic laws, there was no recourse. The Fed had come to the state.
All right. That's serious stuff there, no doubt. But getting back to the Obamacare thing, we see a lot of states that are working on that, both in terms of, and this, also we've been successful in some of this here in Michigan so far, which is to not have a state exchange put in. If all the states don't put in state exchanges, there's a good chance that the Obamacare just falls of its own weight because of the curious ways that they wrote the legislation. And of course, like with so many things, they don't have enough federal employees and agents to do this stuff if the states don't cooperate. One thing we did was, so far in Michigan, we've prevented there from being, and working in conjunction with a lot of other people. I mean, you know, many hands make light work or something like that. It all takes teamwork. So we don't have the state exchange. Now, the other side on this issue, they get it wrong continually. First, they say it's the law of the land. Well, it's not the law of the land. The law of the land is only, Sally, as you know, it's only the Constitution and laws made in pursuance thereof. It's not just any old thing that the politicians want to do, and it doesn't change because somebody won an election or lost an election. I mean, it's all nonsense on their part. But we have managed to keep the state exchanges out.
Agencies, I'm interested to know, can you nullify something that the FDAA has created or that any one of the state agencies at the federal level has created? Is that nullifiable?
Well, that's a very interesting question, but I'm just going to stick to what you asked about what we're doing here, and I'm going to stick to what I know about what's happening here and in other states with the 10th Amendment Center on this. So with the Obamacare now, they say we stopped the state exchange in this state and a lot of other states right now, and there are efforts to totally nullify it and to say the state that will not participate in any way. And I think there may also be eventually some efforts to either interpose or to have pass healthcare, total healthcare freedom acts for each of these states. And so we get the government out of healthcare like they should have been in the first place, like they used to be, because they have no delegated power to be involved in medicine or health insurance or things of that nature. So that's an area where there's a lot of work going on there, Sally. Also in the gun control area, because we have the natural right to self-defense, and that natural right to self-defense and the natural right to own property that's peacefully and voluntarily acquired, those things are protected by the Second Amendment, protected against the Fed's incursion. Because, again, the Bill of Rights only restricts the federal government, not the state governments, but most state constitutions, including Michigan's, I don't know about New York's, but yours is probably like ours, have also protection for the right to self-defense and the right to be armed, if you so choose. So there's a lot of work that's going on there. Various states have done some great work there. Kansas, in their gun control law that their Governor Brownback passed, I think even included criminal penalties for federal violators. So there's interposition for you. And I think Missouri did something very similar. Texas is working on it. And I think the governor of Alaska, I just saw this today, the governor of Alaska, I believe, just signed an anti-gun control bill. You know, no Second Amendment violations there. And there are also, some Firearms Freedom Acts that some states are putting through. And some of those will say if it's a case of firearms being manufactured within the state boundaries, they're not subject to the interstate commerce. They're not subject to any sort of gun control. So they're trying to attack two issues at once with that one. Also now, the feds were not delegated any power to tell people what they could or could not put into their own bodies. And so in a number of states, including Michigan, there have been laws either for marijuana legalization. Well, Colorado and Washington just passed those. But Michigan and some other states have medical marijuana laws, which as does California. That's another one that comes to mind. So there's another aspect. There's hemp freedom now. You know, hemp is a crop that they can grow that apparently has tremendous attributes to it. It's very useful in many different ways. George Washington apparently grew it. They say I think it's the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution or maybe both. It was actually written on hemp-based paper. And Henry Ford thought that was, in fact, in World War II.
That hemp would save our forests and save our trees because the amount you can grow on a very small, an acre of hemp is worth, what, I don't know, 10 acres, 100 acres of trees. That's very important. But I'll tell you also from a vaccine perspective, this hemp oil is doing miracles with these brain-damaged children who have up to 100 seizures a day. And these are very painful seizures. These are not just buzzing out and coming back. These are painful. And $100 a day is what it costs to be on the medication. When they pull the medication, he had to find another outlet, a father I was speaking to, and he said his son went from 100 seizures a day to 2, and now he's seizure-free on hemp oil.
Well, that is very interesting. I hate to hear about the seizures, but yes, the hemp has a lot of good properties to it. And so we have states now, I mean, Colorado did this, they passed the Hemp Freedom Act and that sort of thing. And, of course, you know, the government used to tell you to grow hemp for victory back in World War II, but, you know, the corporate special interests and the politicians get together, but they have no delegated authority, no right to do that to tell people they can't grow the hemp. So, again, that's another area where we're seeing a lot of resistance. And I think the TSA is another area where the 10th Amendment Center and others have gotten together to fight back to nullify. They tried to do it in Texas. I think they backed off or backed down for a little bit, but they may make another go of it. But here's another really exciting thing about all these efforts, Sally. And the issues, sometimes there are issues that appeal to people on the right or people on the left and sometimes to everybody, but there's a really growing reawakening here in America of what federalism is about, what freedom's about, and what we need to do to protect ourselves against incursions on our freedom and on our liberty by a runaway federal government on the banks of the Potomac. And the nullification and the interposition play a huge role in that. These are vital tools, and they have noble history, and the people are awakening, they are reawakening, they're learning about them, they're utilizing them, and it's spreading like wildfire. I know here in Michigan, and it's probably the same in New York and where the listeners are in their own home states, this is an area that is uniting people across party lines. It's taken off all over the place, and while people in the political establishment try to get something in narrow confines of, you know, red party, blue party, and that sort of thing, the people are starting to say more and more, forget it. We know what our rights are. We're going to defend those rights, and we're going to hold all of the office holders from the municipality to the county to the state to the feds accountable. We're going to hold them all accountable for their oath of office, which says they will uphold the Constitution. And when the Constitution forbids something, when they're not and they're not delegated the power to do something, they try to do it anyway, we're going to stop them. And I think that resistance is going to grow and grow. And the 10th Amendment Center has done great work in that regard on so many different issues. And we talked about Patriot Coalition, and they're doing great work. People Against the NDAA, I mean, my gosh, what young Dan Johnson has done with that, that's great. I mean, other groups are involved in some of these fights, too. I mentioned Campaign for Liberty. I mean, there's a lot of great work there, too. But the 10th Amendment Center.
Dan Marburger with the 10th Amendment Center. Michael Bolden is the founder. And you're going to give me that wonderful video from the legal person. And what is his name?
Oh, well, there's Blake Filippi, who gave a nice
Blake
speech at the Nullify Now.
We don't have any more talk time. I want you to say goodbye to everybody, please, Dennis Marburger.
Thank you. This is Dennis Marburger. Thank you, Sally. Thank you, everyone, for listening. God bless all of you. And nullification, the tools to resist tyranny in the 21st century. Thank you.
Ban vaccines 2013 or nullify. Cheerio.